Welcome, everyone, to Kids A to Z with Dr. T. I am your host, Teresa Signorelli, and we are bringing you information about the five areas of child development, and that includes physical development, intellectual, social, emotional, and moral development, and our mission is to empower our parents so their children can thrive. Well, today we have a Brains in Toyland segment, and we'll be talking about play skills in children and a little bit about especially pretend play skills. And we call the show Being Serious About Play because it truly is a really important medium for learning and for children to develop. So I have asked Dr. Dana Battaglia to join us today. She is a speech-language pathologist and an assistant professor at Adelphi University in New York, and she's here with a lot of information. And actually, before I welcome Dana, I just want to mention she and I did our doctoral program together, so I thought it'd be fair to disclose that, but I've known Dana for a good long while now, and I've just always admired her work and being with her and the information she had, so that's why I wanted to ask her to come on. So with that, Dana, are you there? Welcome.
I am here. Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here. And
great,
Teresa,
great.
The feeling is mutual. So I'm honored to have been here, and it's been a long and exciting journey, and here we are, and tomorrow is, you know, there's more to come.
Yep, exactly. And there is a lot, actually, for us to cover. When Dana and I were preparing this, we just realized there's just so much information, and so we can't include everything that we really wanted to talk about today. So we'll give you some of that today. But before we get into play skills and play development, Dana, why don't you tell us a little bit about, just briefly, who you are and what you do and why you're the authority that we would want to have here.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I've been a licensed speech-language pathologist since 2001, and prior to then, I was and still am, these are overlapping credentials, a teacher of the speech and hearing handicapped in New York State. I'm presently working at Adelphi University, where I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders. And I further hold a consultancy at the Genesis Eden 2 programs for individuals with autism spectrum disorders, as well as maintain a small private practice. A lot of what I do is based on analysis of behavior, but that behavior as a speech-language pathologist includes play. And so that's why this issue is a matter of seriousness for our show today, because a lot of times when we're talking about what's going right and maybe what's not in child development, we forget about things that are so important, like children playing.
Right, right. So what? Let's talk about what play is. Maybe give a definition to parents of what it is, and so they understand why it's so important and why we really want to be able to nurture it in the best possible way.
Sure. So in children, play is essentially any kind of spontaneous activity that is essentially intrinsically motivating. When we think about adult lives, we think about activities such as golf and tennis and going to the gym or going to the theater. This is essentially adult form of play, and it's rec and leisure. But this play in the adult form begins as early as grabbing and shaking a rattle for an infant. So there is a trajectory, and it starts very, very early on.
Right. And we talked about, we've mentioned that it is important, but let's reiterate why. Why is it so important?
Well, you know, when we think about play and children is essentially play is essentially a representation of the child's thoughts. When we observe children play, we are observing their reality, and it's therefore symbolic. When we think about later communication, that stems from a child's experiences and explorations, and therefore play is a prerequisite for meaningful and effective communication with others.
Okay. And so let's talk about why we would want to nurture then play skills in children a little bit more.
Well, when we think about play, I mean, there are so many different definitions, which we'll talk about, but there is a tremendous overlap in play behaviors such as, for example, feeding a doll, and language behaviors such as saying the word doll. And there is a substantial amount of development going on between the two. At the most basic level, when we think about play, it's about learning that objects exist in the world, and how a child can use them in a fun way. And then this later advances to using them in a way that represents their understanding of the world. So if we go back to the feeding example, when a child picks up a bottle and feeds the baby, that's an example of their own experiences. And it later morphs into social skills such as playing house with other peers, let's say in a preschool classroom. Specific to language, of course, there are multiple skills involved, ranging from vocabulary to problem solving and social skills. My interdisciplinary colleagues would also attest to the fact that it's not just about language. Play also involves cognition, motor development, and sensory development. And I'm sure I'm missing a few.
The social, I think the social-emotional aspect where you can act out emotions you may be feeling, and that would probably be lead into, one might argue, even moral development, where you can practice and act out those types of decisions. So one of the things we wanted to focus on today was a more sophisticated type of play called pretend play. So can you expand on that a little bit so our audience has a picture of what we mean when we say pretend play, and maybe give us some examples?
Yeah, absolutely. So pretend play is also frequently referred to as symbolic play, although they're not exactly the same thing. And I'm going to delineate them, and then you'll understand why they're frequently terms used interchangeably. When we think about pretend play, it is generally a form of activity where the child correlates with a physical act, and there's some sort of material or an object or an actor involved, such as if we go back to the example of feeding a baby. Even within the concept of pretend play...
Oh, let me just jump in there for a second. So
that
physical act would be feeding the baby, and the material would be the actual doll and maybe the bottle that they're holding.
Exactly. Okay. And even with this concept of pretend play, there is a hierarchy, essentially terminating with this idea of symbolic play. So even though symbolic play falls within pretend play, pretend play is really the more rudimentary, and symbolic play later involves using unrelated objects as tools within a theme. So, for example, setting up blocks to create a town, or putting, let's say, a little model toy, such as like a Dora the Explorer, on a spoon and taking her on a boat ride in a play scene involving maybe fishing or a bottle of water, a body of water. These are examples of, yes, pretend play, but more specifically symbolic play.
Okay, so when you say a hierarchy, there are steps, and the more simple steps, like in pretend play where you mentioned the feeding of the baby, the child isn't actually a mom or a dad, but they're pretending to be, and they're feeding a doll that looks like a real baby with a toy bottle, versus that more abstract, more difficult, higher-level play and symbolic play where you're having... you mentioned blocks representing maybe buildings in a town or a spoon representing a boat, where they're still pretending, but at a higher level.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, great. And we're going to talk a little bit about how and when that all develops so parents can have a nice idea. Before we jump into all that developmental sequence, what is it something, as a professional, you found that parents are often unaware of in regard to play skills? Or what are they often surprised to learn regarding play when you talk with them, maybe, is a way to put it as well?
Right. Actually, I have two points here that I'd like to speak to. First of all, we have to think about the fact that our homes and our lives are flooded with technology. And I'm not trying to say anything negatively about that, and this is not a judgmental statement. We live in the digital age, and there's easy access of devices, tablets, computers, phones are really computers, you know, things of that nature. I think parents, and myself, by the way, as a parent is included in this, sometimes account for time on a tablet or on a computer as play. And while these skills are certainly important, given that our children are digital natives, they do not substitute for old-fashioned play on the floor that involves getting dirty, and getting low to the ground. So that's my first point. My second point that I think parents are not aware of is that only later developing children can actually play independently for extended amounts of time. That said, setting up a child with a toy, even if it's a new toy or a present, which is always very, very exciting and thrilling to a child, realistically only buys a parent 3 to 5 minutes to, let's say, get dinner started or get a another child off to another sports event or something to that effect. So, again, as a parent, I'm guilty of that because we all live very, very busy lives. But I just wanted to say that children do not play for extended amounts of time, and sometimes we think that they can because, let's say, they have a new toy, and that's not necessarily true. It's an engaging process, and it requires people, if you will.
Yeah, people interacting. I think that's a really important point. And I, and for those who've listened to the show for a while, I have such mixed emotions about technology. It is wonderful. But it could also be not so wonderful. And that, yes, that not to count that time on that tablet or that digital electronic item as play and getting down on the ground, rolling around, getting dirty, moving, feeling, et cetera, is so important. And especially that interaction with a parent who can help guide. I think we don't have a plan to talk about it here, but being on the floor, there's that play approach called DIR, floor time. I've had another speech pathologist on a few weeks ago talking about that and really letting the child lead, but having that adult there to guide them and help them make it to that next level of sophistication is important. And maybe we can revisit that another time. But
sure.
Let's start talking about the milestones, so those behaviors that we would want to see as children grow in terms of their play skills. What do we want to see at particular ages or age ranges? And maybe, Dana, as you talk about that, suggest an activity or two that a parent could do to foster skills at that age.
Okay, great. Well, there are lots of different ways that researchers and clinicians have talked about play. So I am sticking to one, just for purposes of clarity. But again, I'm open to discussion about, you know, overlap and shared and diverse perspectives on play. So Carol Westby developed a play scale, essentially dividing play into 10 specific stages. These stages are estimated, and they are assumed to begin at approximately 9 months of age. I do want the audience to know that these stages are not hard and fast. They also can stand to start and end very quickly and at times can overlap, and that's all okay. So just to let you know, basically what I'm going to be doing is talking about stages and then talking about how, you know, the lines are gray in terms of where they start and stop.
Right.
So the first stage, which is called formally stage one, begins at approximately 9 months of age and ends at approximately 12 months, so the child's first birthday. And the child is basically demonstrating means, ends, behaviors. Quite simply, for an example, a behavior might look like a child pulling on a string toy or maybe activating a pop-up toy, let's say while sitting on a high chair and having the tray top on the high chair while even eating. So the child's already multitasking at stage one. In stage two, I know, right? We're
right.
Beginning early. In stage two, which is approximately 13 to 17 months, children are actually exploring toys purposefully. This is when you start to see a child engage in trial and error behavior. So it's almost like they're doing their own little research experiments. A child might stack up a few toys and wait to see how long it takes before they fall down. If they're unsuccessful at whatever they're doing, which can include knocking down a tower, a child will seek out attention of an adult for assistance. Then moving right along in the trajectory, we have stage three, which is 17 to 19 months of age, where children will actually use their own body and tools. Again, we talked about that earlier. A child may pretend to go to sleep They may pretend to brush their hair. They may pretend to eat from a spoon. This is also sometimes called auto-symbolic play. They might demonstrate the use of objects as tools, so maybe use of a stick as a push toy, and they might use other tools as shovels, let's say, to find hidden tools. So you start seeing some more agent type of activity happening at this point.
Okay, so just to recap what we have there, we start to see the real play emerging around 9 to 12 months, and you had mentioned this is means end, so children are just pulling a string toy or hitting a button and something pops up, but there's not a lot of purpose. But once they start to get into stage 2, that 13 to 17 month age range, you talked about them being little explorers and starting to experiment with a trial and error type of approach. You'd mentioned knocking down blocks and seeing how many they could put together before something fell. And then around 17 to 19 months, again, these are all gray range, gray areas and ranges, stage 3, we start to see, you'd mentioned auto-symbolic play, so auto meaning to themselves, where they're pretending themselves to be sleeping or pretending to eat or pretending to sleep or do something like that, but it stays to themselves. And that's what you meant by auto-symbolic? Okay. And then what about next? So that was stage 3. What do we see around stage 4?
Okay. So stage 4 is estimated to happen between 19 and 22 months of age. So again, I mean, if we look at these stages realistically, we're looking at 3-month windows, right? So there may be, again, some overlap. You know, this may happen earlier, something may happen later. The first mention of symbolic play starts at approximately stage 4, or the first symbolic play act, in which the actual play activities of a child will extend beyond her physical self. If we return to that doll feeding example, the child may now feed himself, then the doll, then the caretaker. So during this stage, the child will also be observed maybe combining two toys and pretend activities, such as putting a spoon in a pot and mixing soup. An example, a personal example I'd like to share here is at one point when my own son was 20 months of age, he was sitting on his little picnic table, and I was giving him a snack, and he had just gotten a new dinosaur, and he actually set up his dinosaur next to him and went and got another doll and gave each of them one of his cookies and set up a pretend play scene where he was actually having his snack and sharing with others. And that happened at around stage 4.
Okay. So
it was very cute. I had to take pictures.
Yeah, that is really cute. So those are behaviors we'd expect around 19 to 22 months grossly. And so what might we expect at the next stage, stage 5, and what would that month age range be?
So now let's think about this a little bit. Stage 5 is estimated to be halfway through the play stages, and it's at 24 months of age or 2 years old, colloquially, right? If we think about this, like, just pragmatically, play begins to simulate or represent daily experiences. So a child screaming at, let's say, his Sesame Street characters, "You're in big trouble, Elmo," would be an example of representing daily experiences. Or, you know, if you have a child that goes to preschool at that time, in that time range, you might see the child coming home and mimicking something that they may have observed in school, whether it's a preferred behavior or a not preferred behavior. While expanding, let's say, the play repertoire, it's important we have to think about, even though these things are happening and the distance between when they actually are observed and the child is actually reenacting is increasing in time, we should also note that these interactions are still very short, and they don't necessarily have extended sequences. So Johnny could come home from school and say, "Mommy, Gabby smelled a flower," and then Johnny's already having his chocolate pudding. Like, he forgot about it already, you know? So during these stages, for example, another example would be, let's say, block play. involving not just stacking up the blocks, as I had explained earlier, but now getting the blocks, stacking the blocks, knocking them down, and repeating the sequence a few times. So it's still short, but it's becoming more sophisticated.
Right, right. Okay.
Okay.
How about the next stage?
So stage six is estimated to be at approximately 2.5 years of age, where now these simulations, if you will, or these representations of the child's life include those events that are less frequent, although meaningful. So, for example, visiting a doctor, visiting a favorite friend, or maybe pretending to visit an out-of-town relative, going grocery shopping. For this stage, realistic props are required here. So, for example, a shopping cart to pretend that the child is grocery shopping. And roles between the interactive partners and these scenes shift very quickly, sometimes more quickly than a parent realizes. So you might have this super engaging, attentive parent that is making a pizza, and suddenly their child is off building a tunnel.
Right.
Sitting there making a pizza, not knowing what happened, you know?
Right. But that's okay. And that's part of what
totally.
We mentioned a little bit earlier about the parent following the child's lead, that they should be playing on a level that's developmentally appropriate for them. But that parent can be there to guide them and cue them to maybe do something a little bit more sophisticated. And over time, as I guess we'll talk about, we'll see those scenes shift a little more slowly, and maybe there are more steps to that. So I guess just to recap around that stage four, around 19 to 22 months, we're starting to see that symbolic play where they're not just doing these pretend actions on themselves, they're carrying those over to other dolls and other caretakers. And then they're starting around 2 years of age in stage five to represent daily experiences, so talking to their doll or about going to the doctor maybe, or maybe the doll didn't clean up their room, so they scold them or something like
that.
The
doll is in very big trouble, yes.
The doll is in very big trouble. But that's a really wonderful way to see how they're communicating and what they're understanding and what resonates with them in terms of what happens in their lives. So I'm looking forward to revisiting these stages, talking with a developmental psychologist who can talk about emotional development a little more there, too.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, but from our perspective, language is always our focus for us as speech pathologists. And then you had spoken about stage five at around 2.5 years of age, where they're starting to include that symbolic play of occurrences that are less frequent. Going to the doctor or maybe going to the movies or something, visiting a farm, something less frequent, but that those scenes are still short and they may shift quickly. So as they approach that 3-year skill level, I guess that's stage seven now, what would we say?
Mm-hmm. So we have to think about this in terms of, you know, I always like to describe this as at this point we just get to see more. Okay, so that's the short answer, but the reality of it is that at 3 years of age, we're at stage seven, the child continues to do everything that he's been doing up until this point. The shift, however, is in play being now a sequence of events rather than one isolated event with maybe a few subcomponents. So an example to highlight this would be, let's revisit the use of the spoon, as mentioned earlier, for feeding or mixing a pot. In this stage, the child may obtain all of the necessary supplies, combine ingredients, mix a cake, put it in the oven to bake it, take it out of the oven, blow on it as if to cool it, cut the cake, serve the cake, maybe sing happy birthday, which the happy birthday scene would be like its own play set in a previous mm-hmm. stage, expressing the pleasure of tasting the cake. All of that would be seen in stage seven. An example also that I wanted to share personally, I interjected earlier an example about making a pizza. My son is going through a pizza making phase right now, and what he will do all of these things to make a cake, and then he will move on to make a pizza. And the funny part about this is that he does have a play kitchen set, and his pizza items are too large for the kitchen set. But he will still play, and I will revisit this exact point later. So what he will do is he'll make his pizza, he'll put it in the pizza box, and then put it under the coffee table as if he's baking it. Mm-hmm. Because he's still in the kitchen scene. So he's made a cake, then he's made a pizza, where in previous stages, these events are isolated.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Okay.
And then we move on.
And I
on.
Love the use of the, and I just love his, that, his symbolic play, his ability to use the, I think, what did you say, the coffee table as an oven.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually
great.
I would love to take credit for that, but he did that on his own.
Okay.
You know, he just saw something larger than the pizza box and said, "Up, oh, there's the oven," you know?
Right. So that actually could have been an example. If you see your child struggling that their pizza won't fit in their play oven, a parent could
use
suggest, "Hey,
table.
We can use the coffee table as an oven." So that could be a way a parent could cue a child to a more sophisticated way of play, but your little man did it all on his own, so good for him.
Yeah. Yeah, well, thank you.
Very good.
But the point is, absolutely, I mean, you could use anything. You could have, you know, another parent could use, if they have a tent, you know, and say, oh, that's mm-hmm. the oven. It doesn't, a tent mm-hmm. doesn't always have to be a tent when you're playing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It could be a hungry
yeah,
monster. It could be, you know, a friendly monster. It could be an oven. It doesn't matter.
Right.
That's what's exciting
so that's,
about play.
Yeah, that I'm just thinking of that mental flexibility of having something stand for something else, that it isn't really what it is. It's a symbol. So that tent could be a symbol for an oven, or that coffee table could be a symbol for an oven, or a bed, or a boat, whatever you want it to be. But having that mental flexibility is a really wonderful skill and a really wonderful intellectual exercise. It's using your mental muscle, using your brain in different ways, which is nice.
Yeah, absolutely. And really,
right, so
stage
that,
eight.
Oh, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I was just going to say
go
stage
ahead.
Eight again. I keep using that word more. Stage eight is more of the same, where the child becomes more creative and more symbolic. Mm-hmm. The child may use, this really leads exactly into what we were just saying. We kind of skipped ahead, I guess, or I skipped ahead. The child begins to use non-traditional items to represent other items. So blocks or crayons may be lined up to represent a railroad track or some sort of an enclosure of some kind. Or if crayons are not available at that time, they might use stems from a bouquet of flowers. Or I'm just trying to think of anything else. Or daddy's highlighters. Or, you know, mm-hmm. something of that effect.
Mm-hmm.
If a child wants to create a scene, he or she will find an object that may or may not be a true representation. But again, mm-hmm. it goes back to that mental flexibility, as you say.
Yeah. And this is, you say, stage eight, around that 3 to 3.5 year skill level age range,
mm-hmm.
you'd say? Okay,
yeah.
Great. So what would we get maybe at the next age range? Maybe, what is it, 3.5 to 4 years in stage nine?
Yeah, so we have 3.5 to 4 years at stage nine, and, you know, at stage 10, it's approximately 5 years, but it might be 4.5, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So just going back to stage nine, the child can demonstrate an ability to problem-solve events that maybe they've never experienced before. So if we think about what we've already talked about, and we talked about, you know, just learning about object function, and we've talked about the child repeating events in different contexts that they've experienced, or, you know, reenacting even lesser frequent but meaningful events. Now we see a child planning ahead. You might actually hear a child say words such as, what would happen if, or I hope, which if we think about this from a metalinguistic perspective is very advanced.
And so by metalinguistic, you mean just in terms of their language skills?
Yeah, just thinking about and talking about language, you know, and
mm-hmm.
talking about a child's own abilities or a child's own experimentation, if you will. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, again, going back to the what would happen if example, what would happen if we changed the doll's clothes? Or what would happen if Daniel Tiger went in the snow in his bathing suit?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's silly. You know, and you'll hear children commenting.
Right.
They might make silly creations. So what would happen if my dolly met a rhinoceros? That would be so funny. So what would they, what they're doing is they, in this example, a child might be taking their doll experiences with their maybe zoo experiences and combining them.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Maybe using dolls as puppets in these play scenes. You know, you see a lot of that kind of behavior where they'll take one scene and interject it with another. So a tiger might be a fireman and might be saving all the animals at the zoo and then going to fly a plane. And all of this is very, very, very silly to a child. Like, they know it's silly, which is really the funny part, by the way.
Right. Right.
You know. And then finally, when we move on to stage five, children demonstrate not only the need for objects, but other peers. I'd like to also interject here and say that this is not the first need for peers. It's just that when we formalize some sort of a way to think about play, we think about it as terminating with a need for peers.
Mm-hmm.
But I can assure you that in previous stages, children certainly are seeking out peers. And what happens, too, is that when children are granted more and more access to peers that are appropriate for them and that have similar interests, they seek out less and less access for parents, which is completely appropriate. You know, it's sometimes heartbreaking for the parent, but it's wonderful for the child. So just going back to stage five, children demonstrate the need not only for objects but for other peers, as I said, and they will coordinate more than one event at a time. So put in a scenario with a peer, they might say, they might have this little discussion and say, let's play school, I'll do my homework, you be the teacher, and then we'll go to the pizza store. And I'll get pizza and you get ice cream. They're very highly imaginative. And this is when you start to see that they're able to engage in cooperative play and take turns seamlessly. And they're not announcing that they're taking turns, but they are taking turns.
Mm-hmm. So one person does one action, another child does another action, and they're often, the actions are related.
Exactly. And they alternate. You know, mm-hmm. And they alternate.
Okay. And so I guess when we're thinking about pretend play and why it's so important, can we talk a little bit about what the skills are really that we're honing here, that we are fine-tuning here?
Yeah. Well, you know, we already defined play in terms of just any kind of intrinsically motivating activity for a child. But the issue here is that play is essentially a child's mission in life. It's not just that it's fun, but it's what they are driven to do. Children will play. And it has a major, major influence on language development. And as we talked about earlier, other interdisciplinary representatives, if you will, so child psychologists and OTs and PTs and art therapists and music therapists, and will also say that play has a major influence on their language in all of those domains, and language is one of those. So,
right.
The
so
two go hand
in addition
in
to let, to just to clarify just a little bit. So, in addition to language, there's the motor, the fine and gross motor muscle movements, sensory development. So, what they're seeing, feeling, hearing, touching, how they're moving through space, that social emotional development. You know, being able to act out and get in touch with their emotions and learn how to interact and navigate situations with their peers and adults and make decisions. That all happens through play. Yeah, that all happens through play. And again, as we had mentioned, as speech pathologists, our big focus and the bigger focus for this talk is play's impact on language and communication. But yeah, it's really, it's across the board. It helps everything. I often say that play is their job. It's their job.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, really, it's a synergistic process, if you think about it, right? I mean, you know, a child is not only showing you his or her representation of the world, but exploring it. So it's not always just a direct repetition of what they see, but it's a repetition and an expansion of what they see. Which is so exciting.
Yeah. And it's always changing and dynamic. And it is fun.
If it's not fun, it's not play, by definition.
Right, right. But it's not just recreation to pass the time, but there's really hard work. The most important work of their lives is going on now. That birth to five range is absolutely the most critical time, and it's setting the foundation and the stage for the rest of their lives. So that's why.
Oh yeah.
I think talking about play, where most of your skills are developed is so important. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. What I was about to say is I always joke around and say when my son is really in it, when he's really like involved in maybe something new or some kind of new play scene that he's creating, he's actually almost breaking a sweat. You know? I mean, it's very serious business, play.
It is. That's why when I was thinking of a title for our talk, it was The Seriousness of Play.
It's very serious stuff.
So since it is so serious and it is so important, what is it that parents or other caregivers can do to foster really good play skills in kids?
Okay, well, the first thing is understanding why play is so important, which I think at this point we kind of have already stated multiple times.
Yeah.
But you know what? It is really, really hard. You know, when you're trying to balance, let's say, a full work schedule, a healthy home life, maybe you have multiple children at home. You know, we all have a lot on our plates. So there seems to be less and less time to play in real life. Make time. It's really important. So play should be a priority. Another suggestion that I can help to, to provide to parents is to lead by example. And I understand that you have already kind of had a show about this, but not only demonstrate, but interact with your child. Take turns. Show emotion. Use the entire body. Change your intonation to demonstrate changes in character and emotion. Be dramatic. It's hard. You know, adults are very serious. We can be very, very boring. But sometimes play is therapeutic for adults. And it's really healthy to lead by example. Another compromise, kind of going back to one of the first comments I made, is, kids love to watch videos of themselves. And what parents can do is videotape their children playing and show them those videos. And that sometimes is a good compromise between that balance, the trade-off between technology and face-to-face interaction. And that's a note that, I mean, there is a wide body of literature on video modeling, but personally I can tell you that when I have shown my son videos of himself playing with toys, he then shuts off the video and goes to get those toys and will play.
Wow.
So I'm not saying use a video to replace the play, but use it as a starter, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
When appropriate, you know what, incorporate music. If you're not watching your television, shut it off. It doesn't need to be background noise.
It's actually quite interfering, that background TV noise. Interferes with a child's ability to think while they're playing, and that's a way to practice their own language in their head and problem solve and think critically. So turning off that television is a beautiful thing, and letting them play and think and hear themselves think, etc. So, all right,
No, it's true. I mean, there have been instances where my son was playing and he said something to me and I couldn't hear him because the football game was on and no one was watching the football game. So, I actually took a step back and said, this is silly. We need to shut this TV off.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Another suggestion I always have to parents is rotate the toy collection. A suggestion I have, and when you do decide to do this, is to do it not in the presence of the child. Because that's fine. Yes. When I'm trying to rotate the toys, it becomes problematic that you're moving the child's toys. The child may not understand that maybe you're rotating. They might think you're taking them, and then it becomes a very stressful situation. But the good thing about rotating toys is that when you are moving toys in and out of rotation, it rekindles interest in old toys.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I forgot I had that, and I do enjoy playing with that. You know?
Yeah, and another thing that I think is important regarding rotating toys, so you're not presenting all their toys all the time, that you're giving them a small subset from which they can scan, they can select what they want, and then right when they're not present, put some away and put others in that repertoire that they have more easy access to. That is very helpful. They don't have the planning and organization skills that adults have, and helping, giving them a smaller subset will help, I think, keep the home clean a little bit better, too. Could be something nice. Being able to put things away. And those are important skills, to also how you're cleaning up and putting away. Maybe we could save that for another talk. But I just wanted to jump in there with that rotation comment. So go ahead.
Yeah, I just have one other comment I wanted to talk, interject here in terms of fostering play skills. Feel free to use non-traditional objects. Use an eye mask, fold it up, and pretend it's a sandwich. Or take a business card and use it as a train ticket to get on the railroad or get on the subway. You don't need every single toy set for a child to play. A child will absolutely play. That's their mission in life.
Right. They're hardwired for it.
It's happening, whether you like it or not.
Yeah. So since play is so important, we want to make sure that it is developing well because it affects really development globally. What are some red flags that parents might see that might indicate they're not developing their play skills or other general developmental skills aren't on target? What are some indications that there might be something problematic with their development?
Right. Well, the first thing I'd like to say is that if you have a child between the ages of, let's say, 2 and 3 or 2 and 4 or even 2 and 5, lack of sharing may not be an indicator of poor play skills. That is something that develops over time, sometimes in conjunction with play and sometimes not.
So just to make sure I'm clear, so just if they're between like 2 and 5 and they're not sharing, that's not necessarily because they have poor play skills.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. There are always other factors.
Able to share yet. Okay.
Yeah, they just might not be able to share yet, and it's sometimes things like birth order affect that. If you have a child who's, let's say, the baby of 5 and always like having to steal away a toy, he's not going to share in kindergarten as easily.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Just to give one example. But that stated, parents should certainly be concerned under a few of these circumstances that I would like to highlight. I have 3 points that are of concern to me, and they're not necessarily in any sequential order. A child does not need to demonstrate all 3, but just some things to look for if you're concerned about your child not playing. First of all, if a child is not demonstrating joint attention during play, that would be of concern for me. Joint attention is a very fancy clinical term that really means the interaction between 3 bodies. Okay, so the child, the parent, and some sort of object of interest. So I always say it's a triadic activity. Mm-hmm. So during the process of joint attention, a child will look at his caregiver, look at a toy, then look back at his caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that sequence of events between the 3 bodies, as I said, is called joint attention. The child is essentially showing or sharing some sort of mutual experience with this caregiver during these what they call joint attention periods. And most likely, when parents are engaged in joint attention, they tend to unknowingly label the item. So let's say an example would be the child looks at mom, looks at the ball, and then looks back at mom. Chances are the parent is going to say, mom is going to say, oh, you like the ball? You want the ball? Okay, I'll get you the ball. Look, the ball bounces. So the mom just said ball four times, right, or three times, and is essentially helping the child understand that that round, bouncy object that he looked at is a ball. Okay, so this interaction, while socially driven, also builds on a child's later vocabulary skills.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first area of concern, is the lack of joint attention. The second area of concern is play for an extended amount of time. I've already mentioned multiple times that, you know, as a parent, you get tired because kids really don't sustain attention. And that's all normal. That's all typical. If a child is observed to play for an extended amount of time without seeking assistance or seeking interaction in any way from any other person, either a sibling or an adult at home, I would be concerned. And the reason why is because, as we talked about going through the Westby 10 stages of play, is that even though play is and should be exploratory, as a child progresses, it becomes more socially driven, and that's the underpinning of play.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the first point is joint attention. The second is play for an extended amount of time, essentially in isolation. A third and a very large concern for me is extreme rigidity in play. So when observing a child's play over multiple instances, which these instances could be over a day, over a few days, or over a few weeks, it's common that children do repeat certain threads. That's common. However, it's
and so
when
by
thread
do you mean certain activities? I'm sorry. And by thread do you mean they certain activities, the same game, so to speak?
Yes, exactly. So the child may play kitchen a few times a day or a few times a week. And when playing kitchen, he may make that same cake and he may make that same pizza. That's okay. All right, because eventually they start adding more items to the pizza or making a different kind of cake and so on and so forth. But when we see play that is repeated with exactness, not embellished upon, no spontaneity interjected whatsoever, or if the child becomes upset if a parent attempts to scaffold their play, meaning build upon or elaborate, this becomes an area of concern for me. Sometimes this rigidity can be random and it can be subtle. So just to give you an example, I once worked with a little boy who liked to play with fruits and vegetables in a grocery basket. So far that seems totally fine. And at first, it seems the items were developmentally appropriate, and on the surface, it appeared to be typical. But on multiple observations, I came to notice that he would become obsessive with the plastic strawberries within the bunch, and that they all had to be on the 45-degree angle toward the south-facing window of the house. And if they weren't, he would become extremely upset to the point that he could not continue his play. That's a level of extreme rigidity that I'd like to refer to, as opposed to just repeating a sequence.
Right, and it's that the fact that he got upset was the big red flag, that he couldn't be flexible enough to tolerate that change.
Right.
Okay. So then what do parents do if they are seeing some of this and they have a feeling in their gut that their child's, they're looking at their child's play skills and they're not feeling that they are on par with where they should be, with maybe where their older siblings were at that age or their peers?
Right. Well, the first step would be to schedule an evaluation through your local early intervention department. So I wouldn't be able to give a hard and fast number because early intervention services are guided by different jurisdictions in different states in the U.S. So I would suggest starting with a phone call to the local Department of Mental Health within your county, and they would be able to guide you further in terms of how to obtain a free evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
I always tell parents, if they're not sure, if they have some sort of a little itty-bitty concern, I tell them, you know what, even if it's a small concern, just err on the side of caution and pursue an evaluation. Sooner rather than later is always better.
Yes. Sooner is always better than later, because if there is a problem, the earlier you intervene, the less intervention you need, generally speaking,
later on.
Over time. Right,
absolutely.
And the later you wait, the bigger the problem can grow, and it becomes harder to mitigate. It becomes harder to to fix. And
exactly. The gap essentially widens.
Yeah. And there's nothing like having an expert in a given discipline look at that child. If it's the play skills, you'd have a most likely a speech pathologist and or a psychologist, sometimes a developmental educator looking. If obviously if language, you'd want a speech pathologist. If it's motor, you'd want an occupational therapist or physical therapist, sensory, and you'd really like an occupational therapist. So, yeah, getting an evaluation with that expert in that particular discipline is sooner than later is really an important point.
Yeah, and you know what? I always tell a parent that's not sure, no child that I know of has ever died. I always say this in a funny tone. I always say no child has ever died from an evaluation they may not have needed.
Right.
You know, so let's just err on the side of caution. And if everything is okay, then that's a great day too.
Yeah. And I think that peace of mind that mom and dad might
absolutely
have
it's worth
result
it.
Of that.
Yeah, it's absolutely worth it.
Happy parents make for happy kids, and parents who are at ease and not anxious will have an easier time of raising children who are at ease and not anxious. So
exactly.
I'm a big fan, obviously, too, of sooner rather than later, and getting that eval if you have any concern. I wanted to talk. We're actually starting to get toward the end of our talk today, and before we finished up, I wanted to have an opportunity for us to talk about the work that you do at Adelphi University. You have a wonderful lab, the Language Observation and Analysis Lab. Talk to us about your work there and actually how families might get in touch with you if they were interested in participating in your research that you do.
Great. Well, thank you so much. So, Teresa, what I'm doing right now is I'm conducting some research on how children who are typically developing and children with autism spectrum disorders are making word associations. And essentially what I'm really concerned about is looking at vocabulary skills. So when presented with one word, does another word come to mind more readily or less readily? Is maybe grammar a factor in how kids associate words, or is perhaps frequency in a language a factor at all, and do kids pay attention to these factors or not? So that's what I'm working on right now. I do hope in the future to certainly expand this work and include an element of play in my research, both in typically developing children and children with language disorders. So yeah, by all means, I would welcome the phone call. My phone number is 516-877-4855, and I'd be happy to speak with any parents.
Great. And so I'm just going to repeat that number, which is 516-877-4855. And, Dana, what I can do, too, is put, if you'd like, I can put that number up on the website for the show and probably
sure.
your email address or website. And so you'd be looking for typically developing children to participate in your study and children who are on the autism spectrum?
Yes.
And what's the age range that you'd be looking for?
Well, as of this moment right now, I'm looking at adolescents, so it's a little beyond the age range of the focus of our talk today. But I am hoping to move backward in time and go toward younger children, so probably within the age range of, let's say, 4 to 8.
Okay, great. So
like the later developing play skills, if you will.
Great. All right, so that 4 to 8 year skill range of children who are typically developing or with who are on the autism spectrum. And what's nice is when parents participate in research like this, they learn a lot. They get some free evaluations and feedback on how their children are developing, which is always nice. And you're helping science, which helps the greater good altogether, which is really nice. And as I said, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I always feel like that's my charge, you know, in our field is always to advance science and ultimately help people. That's what we're here for.
Exactly. Exactly. So the final bit of help that we always end the show with is the favorite advice that our experts have for families, and we call it the 5 fantastic facts for families. So, Dana, before you leave us, can you tell us what your 5 favorite pieces of advice are for parents and caregivers?
Yes, absolutely. I feel like this is pretty much a summary of everything we've talked about, but really, really quickly, the first fantastic fact is that children will play, period. Whether they have physical objects or not, play is observed across culture, gender, and socioeconomic status, and we need to pay attention to them as they do so. The second fact is that play with toys and not only technology, or perhaps thinking about instead of technology, is necessary. The third fact is that I always ask parents to get involved and follow their child's lead. If your child asks you to join in, do so. If she wants your presence, just for purposes of demonstration, be there, be animated. This not only helps your child's play skills, but also strengthens that parent-child connection. The fourth point is that too many toys can be just as problematic as too few toys. So, again, just thinking about rotating those toys in and out, increased access to toys will actually facilitate boredom and therefore weaken the value and the process of play. So we need to think about this a little bit. And then the fifth point, which we really haven't talked about at all today, but I wanted to mention a book caveat. I am really interested in literacy. I think it's so invaluable for our children as they grow. But we have to also consider that books, we have to think about books and consider them sometimes as toys as well. And this is wonderful. However, some books are more like toys and less like books. So they may have, let's say, all the functions of a toy. They might be battery operated. They might be lit. They might be musical. Again, this is all good stuff as long as you're aware that this is not true book reading and rather play with a toy. And this toy happens to be encased in a collection of pages. So we just need to have a good understanding of books as toys and which elements of toyness they have, which, again, we haven't really talked about too much, but it is a fantastic fact that I think parents need to walk away with.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And some of the things we didn't get to talk about today were some of the questions that parents often have. And that regards a lot of the time, you know, well, what toys are good? How should I organize the toys and such? And we're looking, Dana and I, to do a follow-up interview where we can bring you that information. And just the point, this little book caveat you had, is a great one. So we'll look to do that, talking about what toys people should consider buying, how you store them, and you know, what toys might help children talk more or be more creative, et cetera. But that is our talk for today. So, Dana, thank you so much for your time. Again, our guest is Dr.
Pleasure.
Dana Battaglia. You got it. It's Dr. Dana Battaglia from Adelphi University. And, again, thanking her for all her time and expertise, thanking the audience for tuning in. Audience members, as always, if you're interested in giving us suggestions for topics, or if you have questions that you'd like us to answer on the show, or just give us general feedback, we welcome it all. And you can send an email to info@kidsatoz.com. That's info@kidsatoz.com. You can also follow us on Facebook. We have a Kids A to Z page. And if you're interested too, I'm on Twitter at Dr. Teresa. So that's, again, on Twitter at Dr. Teresa if you'd like to follow us there too. But having said that, that's our show for today, and I hope everyone has a great rest of their day.